On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we are checking in on the Hall of Fame voting. See which players are headed to Cooperstown and who might be at some point in the future. We are going to open the mailbag, take some of your wonderful emails before talking about Jeff Hoffman signing with the Blue Jays, and update you on Roky Sasaki and what could be happening next in his fascinating free agency. That and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who thinks that Taylor Swift should be in the Hall of Fame. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and she's really famous.
She is really famous, but it would not, do not put it past the BBWAA to look at even Taylor Swift and say, I think she has to wait a year. We can't just be admitting anybody into these hallowed halls on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. We will be talking about the Baseball Hall of Fame, the results of the voting, which will be announced in a little over a week. But we haven't talked about it since the ballot really first came out, and we wanted to check in on the voting. So that'll be our first topic today. We're going to open the mailbag. Got some great emails from you fine listeners. We have not too much of a Roky Sasaki update, so we'll at least talk about where things stand there, as well as hit some reliever signings. Jeff Hoffman signing north of the border. He took those Canadian dollars, and he was happy about it. But Jake, let us begin. Your journey home has sort of begun as you have transitioned from Thailand to Japan, where you join us. We are recording this on Monday morning, East Coast time. It is late in the evening. Do you have any Roky scoops on that side of the world, since you're over there in the future, 14 hours in the future?
Look, I was walking around just asking people about Roky Sasaki. I will say, Jordan, the one thing that is fun about being in Japan is you're walking around and you're just seeing random people and you're like, that person knows about Roky Sasaki. That person knows about Roky Sasaki.
So comforting. I can't say the same thing where I am in Ohio.
It's silly.
But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe one day we can have that reality here on this side of the world.
Yeah, when he signs with the Guardians. I remember when the Nats won the World Series in 2019 and everyone we went to high school with suddenly cared about baseball and wanted to talk to us about Trey Turner. And it was amazing. There is a element of that, like walking around here being like, which is obviously not true. Like, this is a country of over 100 million people and not all of them have thoughts about the monster of the Reiwa era. I understand. But there is something that like is invigorating about just like ball returning to my life in that way. In Thailand, yeah. No one had any thoughts on splitters.
No, they didn't. All right, let's get to it. It is time for the opener. Jake, it's time to talk about the Hall of Fame. This is a topic that has ranged in intense interest level. There are probably off seasons in the past where we would devote multiple episodes to this topic. We are not really like that anymore. Part of that is just because of the way our jobs have developed. Part of it is because, hey, there's been a lot of other stuff happening that's been keeping us busy. We haven't just been like, oh, pull up the tracker. Let's see what Carlos Beltran is at. But now that we are approaching the announcement, the election of Ichiro and likely CC Sabathia and definitely likely Billy Wagner, we want to check in. And of course, checking in is only something that is possible because of the incredible work of Ryan Thibodeau, of, I believe, Adam Dorr and Anthony Kalamis, who, if I'm pronouncing those names incorrectly, please let me know, because these people are doing fantastic work, which is the tracker. There is a public spreadsheet and an incredible resource to kind of follow how Hall of Fame voters are voting and leading up to the announcement at the end of January. And so because of that, you know, I generally in my life, I don't like to have things spoiled for me, but this is the perfect level of information to where, as we were recording on Monday morning, we already know roughly 33% of the ballots that will ultimately be cast, which gives us a great picture. It doesn't give us all the answers, but it gives us an idea of where the electorate is feeling about Hall of Famers. And I think that's cool. And it kind of points our discussion in certain directions.
And this polling data doesn't think Kamala is going to win Iowa, so you really can lean into it a little bit more.
No, that's a great point. I trust this 100p. Now, Jake, let's begin at the top. We did, when we first talked about the ballot earlier this offseason, we went through all the new players on the ballot. And that was because partially a lot of these players, of course, their last season were in 2019. These are players that we certainly have feelings about. But now we're going to take a broader look and kind of just give our biggest takeaways as to what we've seen so far. And I think a good place to kind of start is to remember the rules and kind of realize where we're at. Because for so many years, because the ballot was so bloated, especially because you had a lot of, you know, top tier players who did steroids, and thus you had, they were just kind of stuck on the ballot for all 10 years. It was very easy to get to the maximum 10 spots when you were voting. But over the last few years, we've started to sort of see it clear out to the point where you're not seeing quite as many full 10 people on your ballot because there's a little bit more room. Last year, we of course had the election of Adrian Beltre and Todd Helton and Joe Maurer, and it was Gary Sheffield's last year on the ballot. So that was four spots that a lot of people were, of course, voting for that are no longer, you know, being occupied. And now you have a situation where we're going to give our ballots at the end of this segment. And I think for the first time in a long time, it's a little bit harder to be like, hell yeah, I'm voting for 10, even for us.
And we're big haul people. I mean, yeah. We are participation trophy enthusiasts. I would vote for Taylor Swift if I could. For those of you who are new to Hall of Fame voting, the general rules and guidelines are a player 5 years after their final MLB game is eligible to be on the ballot. Okay, to be on the ballot, you have to have played at least 10 years in the majors. You are on the ballot for 10 years once you are on it. If you fall below 5% of the vote, you are dropped off of the ballot. If you reach 75% of the vote, you are enshrined in the hallowed halls. Now, as Jordan said, for many years, you and I were just like hitting 10 names easy. I don't think we're going to get there this year. But I want to start with Ichiro. Because Ichiro, as far as the public balloting is concerned, has 100% of the vote. And this is relevant because only one player in Major League history has ever received 100% of the vote, and that is Yankees closer Mariano Rivera. I think my most fervent Hall of Fame take is the fact that other players have not gotten 100% of the vote in the history of the institution is a total sham and delegitimizes it to an extent. The idea that people just didn't vote for Ken Griffey Jr. or Cal Ripken Jr., like, it just... what are we doing? Or Randy Johnson, like, what are we doing here? What did you watch? And the notion that players should be forced to wait a year is so goofy and wonky to me. And I genuinely hope that Ichiro does receive 100% of the vote.
I do too. And the reality is it's impossible to know because so many of these guys are so obvious that just being like, well, of course he should have 100% clearly is not enough, right?
No podcast is hopping on the mics and debating whether or not Ichiro Suzuki should be in the Hall of Fame. That is not a conversation that is worth having because the statistical record is so overwhelming. There's no point in even talking about it. And so we can't conceive of someone receiving the ballot and not marking his name down. But that happened with Cal Ripken. That happened with Ken Griffey. That happens with guys all the time.
Happened with everybody. I'm looking
at
the
Jeter.
Derek Jeter, who has the second highest percentage ever at 99.7. Griffey, 99.3. Ricky Henderson only got 94.8. So again, the size of the electorate changes slightly over the years. Babe Ruth, only 95.1%.
Love Babe Ruth getting 95 is great. Yeah. So Babe Ruth, right? He's in the first class.
He's not in the first class. That's why it's so incredible. He's in the second class, I believe. Or no, he is in the first class. I apologize.
But
he's in the first class. He got him and Honus Wagner got a higher percent. Walter Johnson only got 83% and he was in the first class.
What did people think was coming?
Right. Right. How at that point Babe Ruth had me hit like 500 more home runs than everybody else. They're like,
I don't know. I gotta see what else is coming down the pipe.
But okay, but that's 100 years ago, right? But even more recently, the fact that as you mentioned, right, like Randy Johnson, 97%, like Johnny Bench, 96%.
What?
It's goofy. So anyway, will each year get 100%? Does it actually matter? No, especially because like the reality is, as we just mentioned, we can't predict it. And it's not going to make people love Ichiro any more or less. I think the fact that Mariano was the first. So it's like, yes, he would be the first position player to do it, which would, I guess, mean something. But I don't know. But I guess let's just say that. Do you think it'll happen? Because I mean, this is someone for the last few years I've been thinking. I remember thinking about it before Mariano happened and being like, Ichiro will be the first. Right. I like that. I remember thinking that at the time. So in that way, it would be validating.
A take I've had about Ichiro for a long time is that Ichiro had the fewest enemies, the fewest haters of any ball player in recent memory. Part of that has to do with his being on the Mariners, who did not exactly have a foil for much of his tenure in Seattle.
He wasn't breaking hearts in the postseason.
Yeah, like Mariano, right, was like killing the Red Sox all the time, you know. And so you can imagine that there are a certain type of voter, not to say it's rational, who could talk themselves into a certain line of thinking. And I just don't know if you can do that for Ichiro. Now, for Ichiro, the argument one could make, again, I would not make this argument, is if you look just at the MLB statistics, he only has like 60 wins above replacement. Okay. Now, yes, that's because he came over stateside at age 27 after he'd already been like the best player in Japan. But you could squint your eyes and stare and take a nap and jump around on your head and convince yourself that maybe you didn't vote for Ichiro.
But to me, there's no point, like I said, there's no point in having a conversation about that. I think the point that is more important that you're making is just his lovability, his just likability, his popularity, his what he meant to so many people. Forget whether he's exact percentage of the vote that he's getting, just his status as a baseball figure is fairly unmatched in certainly in our lifetime, and probably if you go back even farther, because of just what he meant to not just, of course, Mariners fans for an extremely long time, to obviously an entire country who, not that he was the first guy to come over, but certainly the most successful that we've seen, of course, before Otani at the very least. And he changed the game. And for him to be that good that quickly, to win the MVP and the Rookie of the Year that just immediately, and just statistically, I mean, it's not just the batting averages. The fact that he was intentionally walked as often as he was is both, of course, an indictment of the Mariners, but it's not like the guy wasn't going to run. I mean, he had over 500 stolen bases, like, but people were just like, no, we ain't messing with this guy. He is a menace.
So that's a no-brainer. I hope he gets 100%. I think he's a great player to be the first position player to get 100%.
I agree.
The two other players slotted to get in are CeCe Sabathia and Billy Wagner. Let's do Billy Wagner. As the captain of the Billy Wagner hype machine, I am ecstatic that the most dominant strikeout pitcher in the history of the sport is going to get into the Hall of Fame. Nobody struck people out like Billy Wagner at his peak. What a thing he was. And don't forget that Billy Wagner hung it up before he really needed to, because he wanted to go chill with his kids. In his final season with the Atlanta Braves as a 38-year-old, Billy Wagner had a 1.43 in 69 innings with 104 strikeouts and was like, I've had enough. He is one of the best relievers of all time. I think that the threshold for relief pitching should be higher than for starting pitching. Billy Wagner, in my mind, clears that hurdle easily.
He was 5 votes shy of induction last year, and he has already received votes from 8 voters who did not vote for him last year that are voting for him this year. So he's going to get in. It's his last year on the ballot. Like, he's going to get in. You mentioned the strikeouts. I think it's important because, you know, now there are a lot of like anonymous relievers with 30% strikeout rates, but that he was striking out almost 40% of the guys 20 years ago, before strikeouts were spiking to the degree that they are, really speaks to how different he was. Not to mention what I just like, almost aesthetically, how different he was. And that's another really cool thing about Billy Wagner, that anybody that ever faced him or that saw him when he was pitching and he was a wild hurler at Division III Ferrum, like who saw him then or who saw him in the big leagues, it was like, that is a different thing. And that is what made him so special. And as you mentioned, for him to finish, it's one of the great final seasons we've ever seen from anybody that he had in 2010. And it kind of shows that he was elite kind of through and through from the beginning all the way into the end. And that he will definitely make it this year is definitely very, very, very cool.
CC Sabathia, a player who his inclusion on the ballot makes me feel old, is the first one, right? It's like, in a way, like I delivered CC Sabathia takes professionally.
Sure. That's one way to put it. I mean, again, a lot of these guys, man, it's not, I don't think CC stands out more than Felix or Tulo or Pedroia or some of these guys. And I also think that CC is a little bit different than that group, because his career spanned to before we were paid. I mean, the guy debuted when we were in kindergarten. So, you know, like, that's a long career. Anybody that plays 20 years, and for him to be able to debut as a 20-year-old in 2001 and then, like, have a podcast that we listen to a lot, like, that's a long time, you know? And that's pretty cool.
CC, though, is a very important figure in the history and trajectory of the Hall of Fame as it pertains to starting pitching, because he is going to be pretty low on the innings, the wins, all of those counting metrics that back in the old days don't stack up to old Haas Radbourne's middle finger, right? We're going to have to lower the bar a little bit if we're ever going to want pitcher to make the Hall of Fame. And I think CC represents the beginning of a wave here where we have CC. I know Andy Pettit's already on the ballot. We're going to have guys like John Lester.
I mean, I was just going to say, like, CC is the last one. He's not with that next group. Like,
you think he's the last of his group?
Oh, yeah, dude, he's got 3,500 innings. Like, well, I mean, Verlander is really going to be the last one, but like, the Felix is a different discussion. The guys that kind of next year down, but that's what I think makes him exceptional, is that he does have the traditional, I mean, 560 starts. Like, these are just things, just benchmarks that people are just 3,000 strikeouts, right? Like, these things are just not going to happen for anybody that's not Verlander, maybe Scherzer. And so I think he is a part of that discussion, but he's the last one, and then we'll kind of transition forward.
Right, especially when you compare him to Felix.
Yeah.
Who we'll talk about a little bit later. But the other thing that CC does, at least for me, is he makes Andy Pettit look a whole lot better. Because when you compare those two numbers, I mean, it's right, they're both lefties on the Yankees whose lines and statistics are helped somewhat by having all those wins that come with playing for the Yankees when the Yankees are good. And Pettit's, I know it was a slightly different era, but Pettit is someone who, because of CC's presence on the ballot, looked a lot more enticing to me this season. So we have those three guys at the top, right? The ones who are probably going to get in. Let's update everybody on the other trends within the voting.
Yeah, so let's stay closer to who could be getting in, but conceivably, right? Because besides those three who are essentially slam dunks, then there's 1.5 others who could conceivably get in this year. One of them is Carlos Beltran, and the other one is Andrew Jones. At this point, I think it's significantly more likely that Beltran gets in than Andrew Jones. As we sit here now, Beltran's hovering around 78%. Jones is around 72%. The best and most valuable piece of information that you can look at on this incredible tracker that you can find if you just type tracker.fyi into your browser is how many votes gained from returning voters. This is really the whole thing, because this is how you see the progress that is being made. Because you can't just look at, what the number is right now and say, all right, great, Carlos Beltran's at 78%. That means he'll be at 78% when this is over. Look at how many people who did not vote for them last year voted for them this year. And to see that Carlos Beltran has received 18 new votes in his third year on the ballot, and Andrew Jones has received 9 new votes, which, again, that's not insignificant, but he was starting from a little bit of a lower place, if I recall. Or no, I guess they started similar. Andrew Jones got 62% last year, Carlos Beltran 57% last year. That is where you can have a sense as to where the electorate is moving. And Beltran in particular, someone who, on merit, if the guy didn't get have his involvement in ye old trash cans down in Houston, he's probably in already. And I think we've always kind of rolled our eyes at that, but also understand that that's the kind of thing where that almost makes a little bit more logical sense of we're going to make this guy wait for a year. Now, not that he didn't sort of receive punishment, which is AKA, you know, losing the Mets job. I mean, that was not necessarily punishment, but it is something that a consequence that certainly happened with him. But as far as the actual resume, I mean, he's one of the greatest all-around center fielders we've ever seen. So, and one of the best switch hitters of all time, which I think is also important.
Time does not make him more or less innocent for his actions during the can-banging jamboree. But it is easier for people to do the mental gymnastics. Because as the game forgives him, as you see Carlos Beltran behind home plate at the World Series, right? Or work, I think he's working for the Mets now, right? As the world accepts him back in, then you see that reflected in the way people are voting. And that at least makes logical sense. Andrew Jones, I'm fascinated by as someone, he doesn't do it for me. He was just so bad after age 30 in a way that was such a bummer. He just doesn't do it for me from the offensive standpoint. And look, like, I understand that for some people he does, but it is interesting to me that he's trending in that direction. So then you have all these people kind of in the middle of the ballot, right? From like 68% to 5%. The people who are going to remain on the ballot for next year, who are those names?
So again, if you're below 5%, you're gonzo. So, you know, there's a couple of people at the bottom who have gotten a few votes, but getting to 5% might be hard. But if you look at the ones who are still going to be on there moving forward, we're talking about Chase Utley, who's currently at 53%. We're talking about Andy Pettitte, as you mentioned. A-Rod and Manny are both still on there. Jimmy Rollins has gotten an uptick in support this year, which is kind of interesting. Bobby Abreu is around 21%. You have the lefties, Andy Pettitte. You have Mark Burley is on there. He's likely to stay on there. And then you K-Rod, I should mention, is down there. He has not really made a lot of progress. Omar Vizquel, of course, that's a candidacy that is not going to make any progress anytime soon. David Wright, who managed to get enough to stay on the ballot after he debuted last year. And then the last one who is now officially safe and is, of course, important to me is Felix Hernandez. And I just want to do the Felix conversation now because I think it's sort of related to the one you just mentioned with Andrew Jones. And Felix has already gotten, he's currently at 26% of the vote, which means he's going to be clearly have 5%. Doesn't mean he's anywhere close to being inducted this year, but he's certainly the debut guy that has gotten the most written about him over the last month because it is such a unique case. And the reason I transition off of Andrew Jones is because it is somewhat of a same conversation. For the first 10 years, there was no doubt. He was one of the best. He was one of the best players, one of the best pitchers of his era, arguably the best pitcher, or at least in the top two or three over an 8, 9, 10 year span. And then it was over. And when you say Andrew Jones and you say, okay, he blew it, you know, he did not take care of himself. He stopped, you know, giving a crap and his career went in the toilet. Obviously, you look at Felix and you look at his inability to adjust, his inability to maintain his, you know, physical
abilities,
yeah, abilities really into his 30s at all. You could say, all right, that's a strike against him. What Felix has is not just the peak and the longevity of the peak. It's how hard he was worked, right? I mean, he was pitching more than basically anybody else over that 10 to 11 year span. And not just that he was pitching more, it's that he was doing it starting when he was a teenager. And this is a workload thing that, talk about, doesn't exist anymore. I mean, teams just are not going to let their pitchers do this, let alone most of them blow out and miss a year or two or whatever, and they don't get to throw 200 plus innings a year for 10 straight years. And so part of that, when you realize how hard he was worked, not just relative to obviously what it is now, just beyond considered the norm, but even relative to his peers, you start to understand that, like, you know what? It's just not, of course, the fact that it fell off as hard as it does is worthy of saying, okay, is this a Hall of Famer? But the heights that he reached and how early he reached it and what he was able to sustain, I think is why people are taking his candidacy really seriously. Obviously, I'm biased. He's my favorite pitcher ever. He's the reason the Mariners are my team of choice. And I would love to see him inducted someday. And I'll keep it very simple. I am encouraged and surprised that he has as much support as he already does. And the fact that he's already at around 25% makes me think that it is possible that someday he will get into the Hall of Fame. And I think that that is going to, of course, be the one thing I'm caring about every time this comes around every winter. And it's probably going to be a slow climb, but it does give me hope. And I think there's been a lot of really smart things written about it. Tyler Kepner, Mike Petriello, a lot of great, great pieces contextualizing why he was so great. And why he also, you can still say it's not enough. It's given me a lot to think about. It is a fascinating career, but obviously I'm hoping that one day it happens.
Before we tell people what our ballots are, let's zoom out even further and think about ourselves in the story very briefly as two people who are in the BBWAA. We do not have votes. You have to be in the organization for 10 years before you can vote. We have 8 more years to go before we have that responsibility. How are you feeling about that likely happening to you one day? About getting that in the mail? About doing the research and having this dumb conversation that we're doing right now, like mattering? Now, again, what is mattering, right? But it is mattering within this context. I'm curious where your head's at with it.
I'm still kind of marveling at getting to vote for awards, right? I mean, that's a pretty cool opportunity. Like the fact that I got to vote for NL Rookie of the Year already is kind of wild. I think that the conflicting thoughts I have about this, the one thing is, oh, 8 years, my God, like think about how many things are different. But then you realize that this process basically hasn't changed. And so like more people will get added and maybe we'll see, maybe it's stupid to imagine. But if we do get there in 8 years and this is still what it is and some of these players will still be talking about, I hope that, you know, we're voting on players that we watched. Does that make sense? Like I hope that I feel good about if you know we're lucky enough to get to that point and we do get to vote, that these are players whose careers we, in the way that most of the people of course voting are very much locked in on, but there's also a big part of the electorate that is a lot of names you don't necessarily recognize, because the reality is you don't lose your vote, or at least it's very hard to lose your vote. So
I like how many people get to vote. Mm-hmm. I like how large of a body that is. I do think that it should be culled to a certain extent. So I was sitting at dinner tonight with my wife and she's, what are you talking about on the podcast tonight? Oh, Hall of Fame. She's like, how are other Hall of Fames voted for? A question I never, ever asked myself at all. And I was like, oh, well, they probably do it more reasonably than we do. Guess what? Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, same dumb situation. Like, they just have 500 people who get to vote. You know what I mean? Like, there's no perfect way to do it, to have 10 people who work for the hall itself be the arbiters also feels weird. There's no perfect solution. And so I've kind of landed where I am excited to have this opportunity. And I think it is a cool thing that we get to do. Whereas end of year awards, I am more kind of like morally confused about, just because of how they play into contract stuff. That's a whole other conversation. But like as far as Hall of Fame goes, I am kind of excited to get to be able to do this one day. Okay, so with that in mind, who are you not voting for?
So again, we kind of hinted at it. Would we be able to get to 10? I got to be honest. I don't know if I am 1 million percent locking in what I'm going to say right now, but let's do it.
Guess what?
Do you want to go first? Jordan, it doesn't matter because we're not actually voting.
It doesn't matter.
So I don't know. Like, this might be different than what I said last year, but let's just do it. Do you want to go first?
Sure.
Okay. I think we're going to be almost the same. So let's just see. So you do yours and then I'll be like, yeah, that, but this.
I have 6 no-brainers. Billy Wagner, Carlos Beltran, CeCe Sabathia, the Ichiro guy, and then the 2 steroid bugaboos, Manny Ramirez and A-Rod. My take with them is, yes, I know they tested positive at a time when it was not allowed. They were so good.
Every year, dude. Every year I'm looking at A-Rod, I'm like, oh my God, I don't care what he's saying on Sunday Night Baseball. Oh, what a player.
What a player, man. The two of them, like, and in a way, A-Rod and Manny getting lumped together overshadows what Manny was.
Like, yeah.
Because we're like, oh, Manny and A-Rod. It's like, no. A-Rod, also Manny. And yeah, so,
great call.
Like, if Gary Sheffield's career, if he had been the guy who tested positive on the record, I would like be a little bit more conflicted on it. But for me, I look at the numbers, and for me, it's, you know, OPS plus go brr. So those are the 6 where it's not a doubt. I am a K-Rod guy. I am a Francisco Rodriguez guy. And the reason for that is because I think that the game's 20 best relievers of all time should be in the Hall of Fame. I think that Francisco Rodriguez is one of those 20. His run, particularly at the beginning of his career, from a dominance perspective, was unbelievable. And then he had very impressive longevity. I mean, he pitched in the major leagues for 16 seasons. Granted, the 16th, he had a 7.82 ERA in 25 innings with the 2017 Detroit Tigers, but don't think too hard about that. And he has the record for, you know, most saves in a year. So for me, K-Rod passes that threshold. He's on my ballot. And then the last 2 are Felix Hernandez, because I want to keep him on there because Jordan's my friend. And then Andy Pettit hops on this year just because of CeCe, really. Like, I had crossed Pettit off my list, and then he just passes the test now that CeCe's on there, and I'm looking at the 2 of them side by side. So maybe I'm an idiot. With all due respect to Chase Utley and Bobby Abreu and Andrew Jones, maybe my opinion on you will change one day. But right now, my 9 are Wagner, Manny, A-Rod, Beltran, CeCe, Ichiro, K-Rod, Felix, and Andy Pettit.
I think I'm all the way with you, except I have been swayed on Utley. But it's hard. The Utley one is very strange. I do think that the positional comparisons is very interesting. I think there's an interesting catcher discussion happening right now. I don't know if McCann and Martin are going to actually end up staying on the ballot. I know you could roll your eyes at those, but there have been some smart people writing about them that I've found compelling. But yeah, I think I'm all the way with you. I'm with you on Pettit. I think Andy Pettit throwing 275 innings in the postseason is obviously somewhat largely a product of his teams, and also still an incredible thing to throw a full season in the, I mean, think about it. Are we ever going to see anyone throw 276 innings in the majors in the regular season again? And he did it over the span of, you know, 20 years in the postseason, and he was pretty good too. So I'm in on that, and I think I go Utley. The Bobby Abreu one is funny because, like, you would think there would be enough nerds kind of pounding the table for his OBP, and it's just not picking up any steam. Like, he's gonna stay on the ballot. He's got, I think, 3 more years after this. But I don't know, he's the one where it's like, he doesn't feel like a Hall of Famer, whereas Andrew Jones, I think, absolutely felt like one. And I would also say that Chase Utley felt like one. I would say that Chase Utley did feel like one at his peak, as much as we didn't love watching the Phillies at that time.
I can't speak to what Bobby Abreu felt like or didn't feel like, because by the time I what baseball really was, he was ass, and so I can't. I will say this, though. Having a fan base be able to advocate for you is a really big deal.
Huge.
And Abreu played in Philly for 9 years. Yes. But no Phillies person is wasting time on Abreu when Utley's still on the ballot. And Rollins is still on the ballot. And so, like, that's another dynamic playing against him.
Yeah. So there you go. So I'm with you. I would add Utley and Jones. Okay. I'll keep changing my mind for the next 2 years. That's it. That's our Hall of Fame discussion. Plenty more we could talk about. And we'll get the results a week from Tuesday, I believe. So we'll see if there's any more surprising outcomes once the full votes are finally in. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back here on Baseball Barbecue.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman, and you, the beloved listener, because for our next segment, we will be cracking open the mailbag.
Who would you like to begin with? You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Who is our first emailer?
Our first emailer is Zachary. Zachary says, "Hi guys, you may have noticed this already, but Justin Verlander signing with the Giants will leave the Orioles as the only MLB team that wears orange that Verlander has not yet played for. This would make a deadline trade to Baltimore extra fun, even if raising the already high average age of the rotation may not be super exciting to Jake and other O's fans, including many relatives of mine. I enjoy all your work. Other nice things." Thank you, Zachary. Appreciate it. So I did some research on this. Verlander has played for 3 of the 4 orange teams. Now, it's important to note that there used to be a 5th orange team, the San Diego Padres. I think you could argue at one point had enough orange to be in the mix. They no longer do, thank God. Jordan, there are 2 players in MLB history who have suited up for all 4 orange teams.
Okay.
The Giants, the Astros, the Tigers, and the Orioles.
What about the Mets?
What about the Mets?
What about the Mets?
What about the Mets?
That's Zach said this, like, that he was referring. Remember when Verlander was on the Mets? That was a very brief time, but he was on that. So you have some incomplete research, it sounds like.
I totally forgot about the Mets. Some reason they feel less orange. They feel less orange to me.
They got more orange now than the Padres do. So you want to reveal your incomplete research? Or did these people also happen to play for the Mets and you also didn't notice? That'd be even funnier.
Oh, darn. No. 2 players played for those teams. Enes Cabell, who started his career going 3 years in Baltimore, 5 years in Houston, a year in San Francisco, 2 in Detroit, back to Houston, and then played for the Dodgers for 2 years at the end. So he almost made it his whole 15-year career only in orange. And then the other player who played for those 4 teams is unfortunately arguably one of the worst people to play baseball recently, Aubrey Huff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't believe I haven't been seeing him posting as much recently. I got to be honest. Maybe he's just banned from all platforms.
He could be taking a victory lap or something. But yeah, if you add the Orioles and the Mets in there, obviously you can't. No one has played for all 5 of those teams.
Oh, man. Well, there's still time. I mean, honestly, right? Why doesn't Verlander just sign with the Orioles next year? That's like super plausible.
Totally
doable. If Mike Elias wants to keep signing old pitchers to 1-year deals, like, Justin Verlander could very well be an option again next year.
Orange, you're glad I didn't say Verlander. Also hilarious that I have just erased his Mets tenure from our brains.
You're not alone.
Next email is from Julia. Julia, who is in our fantasy baseball league that I checked every week religiously all season long. Not. Julia says, "Hello, Jake and Jordan." Julia here. Julia and her boyfriend Sam ran their team together, which was just hilarious. "Without doing an ounce of research," she says, "a highlight reel that she links, all of these inside the park home runs were hit by folks under 26 years old. This got me thinking, how old was the oldest person to hit an inside the park home run? And since there are probably a good bit of random old heads throughout the years, what does the overall distribution look like? Does it taper off after 30, 25, younger than that? And of the oldies to do it, were the plays themselves extra fluky? Not sure if this is one the history books care about, just noodling. The question here is essentially, are we already too old to hit an inside the park home run?
Oh, you think that's the exact question? So I've pulled up, again, there's ways to answer this question. Of course, I'm sure the great Sarah Langs could get an answer a lot faster than I could. But just eyeballing, you know, using StatHead Event Finder and pulling up all the inside the park home runs from the last like 10 years, I mean, she's kind of onto something. I mean, I found one here where 36-year-old Derek Jeter had one in 2010. So that's certainly compelling to go back and try and watch that one.
Was it like an Adam Wainwright-style gift?
Where the outfielder the outfielders just didn't just go kind of like bobbling the ball. I have, here's one that's very compelling. I'm seeing that Yuli Gurriel did one in 2023. So that would be definitely the oldest, or at least one of the oldest probably of all time, because he was at least 39 at that point.
For the Marlins?
For the Marlins, yeah.
Because that is the thing about an inside the park home run, right? Like, you got to care. You got to have the zip in your legs still and the desire and the drive to run around all those bases. Whereas at an old age, it's like a Fran Lebowitz thing, right? It's like, well, I don't have to run.
No, but see, I think it's, at some point it flips. I think that like in your prime or like, no, you're not your prime. Between the ages of like 27 and 35, where you're like probably not fast enough to do it, but also like trying to like not get injured, you're not going for it. But eventually it's like, oh, this, I'm old now, like screw it. Like I'm going for an inside the park home run. So I think that it kind of flips back at some age where you're probably more likely to try it.
Right. Like if I make it to 90 years old, I'm going to start smoking so many cigarettes.
Because then it's like, man, I'm invincible. You can't stop me. You wait to skydive till you're 95. I think that's great. I think that's a good way to think about it. But a good question from Julia. Thank you.
Next one is from Adeline. Adeline says, "Dear Jake and Jordan, this is a very silly question, our favorite. But what if MLB expanded the Home Run Derby to 16 players and had four of those players be mystery guest participants? These participants could be current players whose identities they're hiding just for the heck of it, recently retired stars, NPB or KBO players they want to raise awareness about. Each participant could do a WWE-style intro. What four players do you think would make the best mystery home run participants? My answers would be Joey Votto, Shohei Ohtani, parentheses, he could talk about his marriage to a normal Japanese woman. I forgot about that. Jazz Chisholm and Munetaka Murakami." In NPB. This is a great question. I think that we need more mystery in baseball, more intrigue, more surprises, because that is the best part about WWE, a thing I do not care about, is that you don't know what's going, like, you don't know who is going to happen.
Yes.
You know that there will be wrestling.
That is by far the most compelling thing about this hypothetical, because the reality is, like, that intrigue alone lowers the bar for the excitement of the surprise. Because ultimately, if you told me that a month in advance that Munetaka Murakami, you know, Japanese slugger who's coming to MLB next year, if you told me he's going to be in it, like, I'd be excited about that. But by the time we got there, I'd be like, oh, yeah, like, oh, cool, Murakami's
in it. Okay, great.
But, like, if he just appears... You know, like if the range of who could walk out of that door goes from like, you know, the best like freshman college baseball player with a metal bat, like to the best player in Japan, to Barry Bonds as a 50, whatever year old, like all of those options being in play would make
to Shohei
that much better to show it. Sure. To like to just some other active player to like Bryce Harper being like, oh, yeah, I'm back. I'm actually doing it.
Right. And now the reason you can't do that is because you got to advertise the event. Right. And so so for instance, if Shohei agrees to it, you're not sitting on that bullet.
But,
right.
Okay.
You are telling everyone in the world that Shohei is going to do the home run derby so people turn on the television and so you make money. Now, look, I am being a loser here. I understand. Like, I get it. The reason WWE works is because it is bigger than any of these single people, right?
Sure. But I would just say that, like, I think you could still absolutely advertise the mystery. Now, sure, in the case of Ohtani, once you know, yes, of course, you'd rather tell everybody that it's happening. But I think there would be a way to present it as, like, who's going to show up? Now, the risk of that is they show up and it's like, oh, okay. And then everybody turns it off.
This is like, the in terms Bronson of the... Arroyo doing the Masked Singer, where yes. He takes the mask off and it's like, oh, this is our great bit about Seth Smith going undercover. I don't know if we've ever done this in the pod, but you know those videos of the famous athlete where they get all dressed up in makeup and they like go to a junior college team or they go to the park and it's Kyrie Irving doing, what was it called?
I forget. Uncle. I know that ad.
But old Kyrie.
Yes.
But there's a Chris Bryant one where he shows up at a junior college. So Jordan and I had this bit that Seth Smith, like the most nondescript baseball player, would just show up at Central Park and hit a bunch of home runs. And then people would be like, who is this guy? And then he would take all the makeup off. He'd be like, it's me, Seth Smith.
Oh!
And everyone's like, who? Like, it's me.
Uncle
it's Seth
Drew.
Smith.
Uncle Drew was, thank you. Was old Kyrie. Anyway, so, the point is, I think even if you had one mystery.
Just do one. Do one. Yeah,
like,
do one.
Like, almost, like, that almost feels like totally doable. I don't know if we're at the point, like, I think the home run derby's in a totally fine spot. I don't think it's like the NBA where it's like, we got to say, oh, trust me, compared to the other All-Star game and stuff, like, I feel like we're doing pretty okay. I'm not too concerned about that, but I do think that would be a way to make it interesting.
Also, okay, so like as an example, right? If this past year when they did it in Texas, if you had like Matthew Stafford do it, quarterback from Texas, he'd be terrible and he would lose, but who cares? Just put him in the thing. Give me the theater of it, right?
Yeah.
Like, get Denzel Washington, like, in there.
How,
who cares?
How committed would you be to getting someone that you know would hit more than zero home runs? Or at least it would be entertaining. Anyway.
Give me like one of those professional softball chunks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the long ballers. There's some, that is a wild world. I would definitely tune in for that.
All right. Enough mail.
Thank you. You can email us baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Keep those emails coming. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we're going to talk about Jeff Hoffman signing with the Blue Jays of Toronto. A couple other moves before we say goodbye. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Before we talk about Jeff Hoffman, we do want to give a little bit of a Roky Sasaki update, since it is possible we know where he is signing by the end of this week. The international signing period opens on Wednesday. However, based on all the reporting and the way that his agent Joel Wolf has spoke, it does not seem like we will know where he is signing as soon as the period opens, but we do know we have to know by January 23rd when his posting window closes. We're going to keep this Roky conversation a little bit shorter because I think there are going to be developments this week that are certainly good, whether we know or not where he is signing by the next time we record later this week. There is going to be a lot of Roky discussion this week as the international period opens. And here's why. As Ken Rosenthal and Andy McCullough wrote this morning, there is likely to be a lot of maneuvering, shenanigans, interesting transactions going on this week in anticipation of Roky's decision. And the reason for that is, as we know, because he is an international free agent, considered an amateur, there is a limited amount of money that teams can give him. However, teams that think they are still in the mix might be trying to essentially save as much money of their bonus pool, which ranges from 5 to 7 million, but they could trade to a certain percentage up to more than that, to give to Roky if that is part of their, you know, recruiting pitch. So we can give you this larger bonus. The problem is that most of the money that these teams have has already been committed to players in the amateur international market, whether that be in the Dominican Republic or Venezuela or Colombia and so on. And so what we are likely to see, unfortunately, to some degree, is teams waiting to finalize their agreements if they still think that they can give some amount of money to Roki Sasaki. This is a very unfortunate outcome and circumstance for the players involved here. And the actual specifics, I don't want to get too far into. But the point is, we are going to, especially if we start seeing teams making trades for international bonus pool money, which you can do. This is something we saw around the Ohtani signing when he was a free agent. We haven't quite seen it recently, but there is a very good chance that we will see it in some form in the next few days. Maybe not. Maybe Roki says, this is where I want to go. The money isn't that important, and we don't have to worry about this that much. I hope this doesn't make Wednesday's signing day too much of a mess. We are going to talk about the other top players in this class because there are some really interesting stories that also are worthy of attention. But the thing is, it is a very difficult thing to predict right now, not just where he is going, but the full outcome of this. I know there was a report about a player who was originally slated to sign with the Dodgers, who chose instead to agree to a $1.7 million deal with the Pirates. Now, that is interesting. However, I think what is going to be more notable is if it is a player who is reported to already have agreed to a $2 or $3 or $4 million deal, and if that player changes who he has agreed to. Because in the case of the player who changed his agreement with the Dodgers to go to the Pirates, he was not slated to get nearly as much money. And so that is not a situation like that was a situation where, oh, you realize the Dodgers aren't going to give you and another team is going to give you double. Like that's probably a pretty easy decision if that opportunity arose for really any player. It's really more about the players who were already committed big dollars and, you know, $1, $2 million. If those players start changing their agreements this late in the game, now we could start seeing some messy business. So I hope it doesn't get to that point with too many teams, but it is certainly something to monitor as we get closer to Roki's decision.
I wrote about this a little bit deeper earlier in the offseason. It's as simple as there's only so much candy to give out on Halloween. And now that Roki Sasaki is jumping in at the last minute, relatively, teams are going to reallocate some of the budget to ensure they can pay him what he's asking for. That is not Roki Sasaki's fault. Any outcome from his late entrance is a symbol that the league's system is broken and wonky and bad, and not that Roki is doing anything immoral or unallowed himself.
Yeah. And so we'll see. It's just, clearly, this is going to be part of the story this week, unfortunately, which is sort of what I feared. But, maybe we will actually know where he is signing later on this week. But we do have some transactions, including one team, the Toronto Blue Jays, who, by the way, according to Ken Rosenthal, met with Roki Sasaki. All right. Can the Blue Jays finish runner-up on another team, on another top free agent? Maybe they can. But you know who they actually got to sign with them? Jeff Hoffman. Reliever, one of the top relievers available on the market, signing a three-year $33 million deal, I believe, with the Blue Jays of Toronto. There was some reporting that the Orioles were heavily involved in the Jeff Hoffman pursuit and maybe had balked at the medical situation for Jeff Hoffman. There was also some reporting from former podcast guest Ben Nicholson-Smith that the Orioles were still willing to sign Hoffman for somewhat of a revised deal, and ultimately he ended up back with Toronto. I say back with Toronto because Toronto is, of course, the team that drafted Jeff Hoffman in the first round 10 years ago before they traded him to Colorado in the Troy Tulowitzki deal. Jeff Hoffman, someone you've gotten to know pretty well over the last few years covering the Phillies. He is, classic, starter turned one of the best relievers in baseball. And it's a pretty cool story. And of course, there were a lot of other big names on this Phillies pitching staff. But I think by the end of his time in Philly, it was like, oh my God, he is one of the best relievers in baseball. And I think for Toronto, man, I mean, assuming he's healthy, which again, he's been healthy. Medicals, it's not always guys that have had a million surgeries that you go on and be like, oh, he's got a bad medical. Like, teams see things all the time. Teams have different interpretations of the medicals. But the point is, I mean, the Jays, they were one of the worst bullpens of baseball last year. And this is a big deal if he can. It seems like he's going to be in the running to be their closer.
Yeah, he wanted to close and he got more money than the Phillies wanted to give him. And so you end up with a situation where these teams are more or less just trading closers, which is adorable. Mm-hmm.
So Jordan Romano goes to the Phillies and now Jeff Hoffman, this multi-year deal. And yeah, they need it. They still need to do more, but there is a path forward to having like a decent offseason here for Toronto if they can get Santander and maybe Pivetta. Like, I think that's been a big
That's if, exactly obviously. What Jays fans are thinking. Yeah. That's exactly what they're thinking right now. I like Jeff Hoffman. He's a good ad. I think the Jays will be better than they were last year. The path to the decent offseason to me is to rose-colored glasses right now.
That's fine. And again, it's a path that I still feels unlikely. Again, like they've already missed so many times. I'm certainly not giving them the benefit of the doubt. I'm just saying that there are still players out there that fit them very well that would put them back in a position. Whatever. Like I said, they got to extend Vlad. That's the thing that matters the most. So if they don't do that, I'm not going to be feeling very good about them come opening day.
A few other nuggets of news from the reliever market. We'll kind of just turbo mode this. Orioles sign reliever Andrew Kittredge. When I saw this move, I was like, that's a good ad. He's pretty good with the Cardinals last year, throwing irrelevant innings for a bad team, did a good job. They gave him a $10 million one-year deal. And then I saw that and I was like, whoa. And then I remembered that the money's not real. He'll be 35 years old in March. He'll be able to help the Orioles bullpen a little bit.
Yeah, and we'll see if the relief market continues to move this week. Jorge Lopez signing with the Nationals. So looking, of course, forward to his first appearance at Citi Field. That should be interesting. Colin Ray signing with the Cubs. Probably not a reliever. He threw 167 innings last year, which is just an astonishing number of innings for Colin Ray to throw as a 33 or 34-year-old. Seems like they are adding some depth there. But I am really curious, right? We're still waiting on Tanner Scott. We're still waiting on Carlos Estevez. Kirby Yates, again, go look at the season Kirby Yates just had. My God, like he could help any team. And if Andrew Kittredge can get $10 million, Kirby Yates should be getting more than $10 million, quite simply. Then you have Kenley Jansen, Robertson, and Seawald, AJ Minter, Leclerc, a lot of guys like that. So I have a feeling we'll continue to see that market move and where those guys land, because it's impossible to pray. Every team could use these guys. So maybe the Blue Jays add another one. Maybe this is an area where I think the Dodgers could still be shopping, and I think you should definitely be watching them. And we'll see what other contending teams are willing to pay up big for these top relievers.
Whoever Andrew Kittredge's agency is, that's a win.
74 appearances, career high 74 appearances in 2024. He's been an all-star, right? But it's never like huge strikeout stuff. It's just he's getting guys to chase. That's his big thing. 100th percentile chase rate, I think, 4 out of the last 5 seasons for him. So whatever he's doing, people are not seeing the ball very well, and he will be joining that Orioles bullpen. I think that's quick it. Anything, thing. Any final things? Yep.
You know, I just gave some credit to Andrew Kittredge's agency. It's Paragon Sports. A thing I love is when you go to an agency's Twitter account and you just scroll through to see who they're retweeting about. And it's great because it's the same energy for Aaron Nola, who they represent, and also Sam Moll. And also Jonah Bride, and also Christian Yelich, and also Eric Wagaman. And so it's just Eric all Wagaman, over the nice. Place. Yeah. Places, people, teams, players are represented by all kinds of agencies. This is good stuff. Yeah. Jose Trevino.
Oh, good job, guys. A lot of interesting names. Sam Moll, you got to be feeling good. If you're seeing Andrew Kittredge get, you know, $10 million, you're like, ooh, I just got to pitch in 70 games and not suck, and I am going to be absolutely paid. That's it. I don't really want to talk about arbitration, although Cubs, if you want to extend Kyle Tucker, probably not the right time to piss him off. That's all I'll say about that. Other than that, thank you all for listening to this episode of Baseball Barbacast. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. We will be back on Thursday with our next episode, and let's see what news we have by then, because it feels like we're heading towards a busy week.
Thursday, I will be in Tokyo, which means, Jordan, another trip to the greatest baseball swag store on the planet, where I will be bringing home a gift for you, my dear friend. So we can talk about that.
I can't wait. A lot of options. Need that Tyler Austin jersey. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, producer Andrew Hartz. We'll talk to you soon.